Welcome to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast, in conversation with the biggest names in sport, generating insight and engagement around coaching, officiating, and playing hockey. Presented by Jack Rolfe.
It's Caldas, welcome to the European Hockey Institute.
Thank you.
It's fantastic to have you. An absolutely wonderful man and coach, and amazing to have you. And I think if people said Max Caldas, or they put Max Caldas into Google Images, they would see the person that coaches Holland and spends so much time in Holland, but maybe doesn't know or understand that you are from Argentina. You did go to Olympic Games. You did play at a World Cup. You did spend a number of years in Australia. But you're so iconic to Holland. But talk to us about the journey outside of Holland and how you've ended up where you are today and why you're here.
Yeah. Thanks for the intro, for the invite. I started playing hockey when I was, I think, between 6 and 7 in Buenos Aires. Just by sheer luck, you know, we were just talking about it off camera, of the social clubs style in Spain that's pretty similar to Buenos Aires. And when I was growing up, my parents, both of them worked and full time. So in summer holidays, they would drop us in the morning with my family. At the club, you know, you have your summer comes, you know, the whole day, and they would actually pick you up when they came back from work, and if it was nice weather, they would stay in the swimming pool themselves and the rest. And in those summer comes every day, or nearly every day, a different coach from a different sport at the club came and gave you like a mini clinic of basketball, volleyball, rugby, whatever it is. And that day, the hockey coach, the youth hockey coach came to give us a clinic, and he goes like, I really liked it. And he goes like, look, if you want to, we begin this afternoon with the trainings for the season. And it was February, in the February. And my mom was already in the club. She was already in the swimming pool. And when she came to pick me up, I went like, look, this hockey training starting today. And she went, well, if you want to have it a go. Do you want me to come with you? I said, no, I'll be all right. That's the pitch there. So I went with the pitch to the pitch, and I started training like that, you know, just like by sheer coincidence. And in the end, the funny thing about it is that all your biggest mates today, even though I left the country when I was 22, are those kids that started playing hockey together at 6, 7 years old, you know what I mean? And my dad and my mom played volleyball and played tennis, so we're not hockey people, but they just play sport. And they just backed me up to do whatever I wanted to. I always competed at club level in 2 different sports at the same time. So I always did hockey till I was 15. And that's when I chose to stick 14, when I just do hockey. But I did swimming pool and hockey, rugby and hockey, tennis and hockey, all through the youth. And when I was 14, 15, that's when I said, okay, I'm going to stick to hockey. So yeah, that's how I started. And I always had at my club beautiful, knowledgeable, experienced people that taught me that not only the game, but the love of traveling and the love of teaching, because they were all, neither all of them were international players for the club. So every time they went to a trip to Pakistan to play with Argentina or to India or to whatever, they just brought shirts and they just, you know, they did some raffles with the players, or curiosity for traveling and for living and playing abroad. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And when I was 22, I went to Australia. I lived there for 5 years. And then from 2000, lived in Holland until 2021, the Tokyo Olympics, where I moved to Spain, so with the family. So yeah, I'm a bit of a globetrotter. And I like it. Like,
and people still...
Yeah. I mean, the lovely thing about it is that it gives you a bit of perspective of different things, and you get to know different people, different way to do things, different way to approach things. It really broadens your mind. I wouldn't have changes for the world, even though you miss your mom, you miss your brothers and sisters, you miss your friends that you don't see them every day. But nowadays, remember that when I left the country, it was still writing letters, you know? Yeah, the letters took about 10 days to get from Sydney to Buenos Aires or back, or from Perth to Buenos Aires or back. And nowadays with the phones, it's easier. It's been so far a really amazing journey.
And we would have a lot of listeners that coach at that youth level. And you've just shared how important it is to create such a wonderful first experience, because I wouldn't be sat here talking to you and you wouldn't be sat where you are inspiring the players and working with the players and had those experiences if you had not had two great years at that kind of 8, 9 years old to still be involved in hockey.
I mean, the thing is, I remember that in the first 2 seasons or season and a half, I think we lost every game by about 10 goals. We were the youngest ones, little ones, smaller ones, playing against bigger boys. I mean, we absolutely get smashed every Sunday. And the funny thing about it, that coach, Pedro Chamorro, that he's living now in Spain as well, in Galicia, north of Spain, he always find a way to keep us engaged, motivated, happy, through a lot of different things, not only on the pitch, but also just especially off the pitch. And he kept the parents engaged as well. And there's a really, really happy vibe when you went to training, that actually, thinking about it now, I'm going like, wow, we lost about by 17 or 18 or 20, you know, some games you have to troll for about an hour and a half and then hour and a half back. And there was never, I think sometimes that we make it worse for the kids that we bring the pressure of winning or losing when they're young, when those kids don't even realize what that means, you know, you know what I mean? And you need to be very aware of those things, because that guy never did, and we had a ball, you know. And then in the end, when we went to, after, let's say, those two and a half first years, then we won everything until under 18s, you know, year in, year out. And it was not because we lost, but it was because we loved what we did, you know, and we always went to the club with a big smile on our faces. And in creating that environment for kids, for young kids, and helping them along the way to understand the game better, not to understand tactics, but to understand themselves better, how to play the game better, how to improve, you know, I give value to those things. I think that's critical. I think at every level, even the national team level, but for young kids especially, stay away from tactics, just teach the kids to love the game.
Yeah. And we'll talk about tactics in a moment, but is that something that's influenced you as a coach and as a person now, that early experience, that coach that, because I believe you can't see it if you don't, you know, you can't believe it if you can't see it. So that person that was an international athlete that came to coach you, the coach that, you know, was coaching a team that was losing every week, but created such a great environment, you talk about that with such a smile on your face. Has that impacted you as a coach for who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that I haven't deviated from that plan. You know, I remember when I started coaching senior level in myself, it's like you forget those things and you start going to the PowerPoint and side of things, you know what I mean? And I did do the PowerPoints, I did do the tactics, the hard tactics, I did do the want to control everything about everything just to actually make sure that the players think that I am knowledgeable about things, you know what I mean? And as I'm getting older, 50 now, and I'm still learning and still being very curious, I think that every day that goes past, you go towards the people, you go towards the player, you go towards the individual, you go towards the environment. And because we have systems, have things in place, whether we play now with Spain or we did with Holland. But I think for me, the big critical game changer is the player, is the person behind the player. And I think that's where most of my time is spent, and to create environments where the players can shine, and when they can't shine, just help them along the way, push them, move them around, change the environment, but actually make them equal them, you know what I mean? Just to be the best version of themselves. And now looking back to when I was a kid, thinking about it, and that's what this guy did, you know what I mean? He just actually made us enjoy what we were doing at a very simple level, grass hockey, literally grass hockey, each two at the back of the club with nearly no lights at all, but a lot of the things that happened back then, as you get older, start to come back to you, and you start actually give them a little a different dress, different suit. But you actually just through that thought process, you work like you work today.
Yeah. And I'm sure every coach, they hear that and they would reflect and they think they probably talk too much and they've probably done a 20-page PowerPoint at one stage. But what was that stage for you to think, okay, maybe this is not impacting or not having as much, you know, much as impact as I wanted to have? Was there a moment you reflect on?
Yeah, I remember I used to live in Sydney, and I came to Sydney in 2000. And playing NHL, back then it was called a National Hockey League, back then with Sydney and with New South Wales Warriors. And Larry McIntosh was our coach, great guy, an absolutely amazing guy, and a really good coach. And Mecca, remember one of the first team meetings of a friendly game, he was asking the players questions. I'm like, what? What do you mean? And I remember a very young Fred Livermore, he started asking the questions. And I came from a culture where the coach is, let's say, the boss, and the coach gives you the instructions and you just go do them. And I was thinking, this little brat is not even 20. He's talking before Ken Walk, you know what I mean? A hockey glory. I'm like, what's this? What's this all about? You know, that was the first time that I thought, wait a minute here, there's something going on here. And I remember that moment very clearly. It was in Homebush in the change rooms, and Livers was talking as in Larry, anyone was actually discussing with him things before a game. I'm like, what's happening? You know, that was the first time I thought, well, this is really cool. Let's see how this goes. So that you start slowly but surely to incorporate things in the way you do things. But of course, the first step to make them, when do you make that change? I think that's gradually as you go along, you know. There's still different ways to do things. There's still coaches that actually they demand from the players some of the things that it works for them and for their group. So it's not one way to go about things. But I'm really happy that I took this path and I just try to actually make it better as we go along. But that was, for me, the first moment that I thought, wow, players can talk and players have ideas. Doesn't matter if they're 20 or 30 or two Olympic games or no Olympic games. And yeah, that was for me a really good example of how to develop things. And in Australia especially, I mean, the love of being a coach, I got it from my club in Buenos Aires, from the people that taught me. But the fact that coaching is a job in itself, that I got that in Australia. That's the first time I thought, wow, this could be a profession. You know what I mean? I think back home was a hobby, just not to have to ask my parents for pocket money to go out with my friends. You know what I mean? And in Australia, I found that this is a profession, and I loved it.
And now we fast forward to 2024, where the type of player coming through is maybe slightly different to what it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yep.
How do you reflect on that approach that you've taken that has been successful with the type of players you now see coming through a 19, 21-year-old? What's the impact of that?
Yeah, I think you need to cater more and more for the individual. You know what I mean? You read the books and you listen to the podcasts and you look around yourself from your experience, having kids of your own. Attention span is shorter and shorter. Immediate reward is demanded. They feel that's the way to go about things. Postponing success or postponing happiness to invest in something that they just don't know where it's going to take them now, it's getting more difficult. But in the end, it's about you. It's about leadership. You know what I mean? You need to provide them with a blanket of safety where they can experiment and they won't be punished for it. You need to make them understand together in the journey that you have with a player. What could it look like? Why not? What is he doing right? What is he doing that he probably can do differently? What's going to be the impact of things? You need to try to make them see in their own words, in their own minds, what this going to mean to them. I think that the meaning part of it is very critical, because that's what gives you motivation to do it every day, and understand, especially, that you cannot expect players to do what you did and how you did it because of different time frame. I think that's the critical thing about coaches, that you need to always be adjusting and always be one step in front your environment and the times. You know, I always say in Spain, from the moment that our team manager, Cesar Hernandez, he always tells me, since the day you came to Spain, you're playing chess with our line and with the players, you know. And I thought, well, it's not on purpose, but like, to have an analogy, just, you know, just be one step in front of two in front of three in front to see how things develop and actually move their around in that direction. And and be happy not having to know everything, and be at ease with not having to control everything, you know. And that's pretty healthy in there.
There's an element of having to be vulnerable, I guess, as a coach, and there's this perception that the coach is the king, and there's a perception that the coach holds all the cards, so they're close to their chest, and they're the ones that make the decisions, they're the ones that are maybe the gatekeeper to that individual's development. What are your behaviours, not just your behaviours, but your coaching team and that environment look like, to be true to yourself, to be true to the players in front of you?
I think being vulnerable, I think the misconception is actually makes you weak. And in the end, actually, it makes you much, much stronger. I think if you, the key ingredient is you need to be honest about it. You can't actually fake being vulnerable. You can fake asking a question and wanting to know the player's opinions. You know what I mean? It's just, if you fake it, the players just know it. They smell everything about you. When you walk in the room, they go like, oh yeah, he's cranky today, or he's happy today. And you know, you need to actually be very true to yourself. And I think to be vulnerable, to ask questions, to be curious towards players and staff, I think there needs to be a big investment from yourself in the people, not only in the player or in your assistant coach or in the physio. Just really get to know them and take time for them. For example, on over 2 days on Thursday, I got to have lunch with a player that would just got dropped yesterday for the project in India. You know what I mean? He calls, like, sir, should we go have lunch? I want to talk to you about things, but some things are here, fair enough. And the things that he wanted to talk to me about have nothing to do with being dropped, have to do with him in the future and studies and where he's at. You know what I mean? And I value those things much more than winning a game, you know what I mean? Last Sunday before the final against Belgium in the Olympic qualification tournament, I invited all the parents of players to listen to the last pre-game team talk, you know what I mean, in the change room. Why? Because they were there. It was a surprise for the players. Sometimes a surprise might just keep them on their toes, you know, things they don't expect. And also, I wanted to see them faces with mom and dad, with mom or dad in the room. What happened to that kid, you know what I mean? To those eyes. And I think those things create value for them, and they feel heard and welcomed and happy, even though they know and I know that I'm the one holding the key of selection, you know what I mean? Especially in the Olympic year. But if you're always honest about it along the way, you can drop someone or pick someone, that's not going to change your bond with them. And of course, when always, sometimes you're going to be closer to some players than others, and the other way around. And it needs to be fair enough. That's why I always try to empower the staff to make choices, to pick their own battles with players, just to say the least. I was listening to a podcast of a coach that actually was talking about, you know, if you're going to make a decision, he was talking about his staff. He was going to, if you're going to make a decision, have a conversation with the player that's not going to affect game day, I don't need to know. If it's going to affect game day, just let me know. Just I'm aware of it. Not because I need to know, but because, you know, you may say something that actually goes against the whole idea of that weekend, of that game. And I'm pretty much the same. I don't, if I see a staff talking to a player or a player, I want to talk to a staff player, a staff member that's not me, I'm all right. I just keep on walking, say hello, and I don't ask them, what are you talking about? What do you say? What did you say? You know, I need to trust people. And in the end, I like feeling that I don't know everything. I like feeling that I don't know the answers. I don't have them. Sometimes I go to the player, I just don't know the answer. I'm looking for it. I'm gonna go think about it. I can't give you an answer right now, because in the end, I think that it makes me want to be better the next day again. You know what I mean? And so I'm happy with that. Of course, I struggle in the beginning, like we all do. It's a matter of experiences, because, like you said, you feel you have to know the answer, you have to know everything. And I'm very happy with the feeling of vulnerable and know that I don't have all the answers.
And what I hear, Max, is almost you coach with an element of emotion. Like you talk about love and you talk about care and passion. Yeah. And actually, we actually haven't spoken about tactics once in the last half an hour. We haven't really spoken about hockey.
No.
But we've spoken about the people and the love.
No. So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the end, what I said before, of course, we know what we do, and we have a system. We got system in place, and we talk about certain tactics, about players' development, and things like that. But I think the source that gets everything together, the chips are down, and the game's on the line. I think it's not that pressure of that. Well, they have a 3-2-1. The 4-2-4-4-3-4-1-1 story. I think it's something more, and we choose to be better at that part of it, and then the game itself, the tactic itself, they just come along. You know, it's the other way around with us, and so far it's working quite well.
And a question for you, Max. How do you, so you're this person that coaches hockey and you lead in a certain way. How do you select or pick the staff that you work with that get the best out of you, that you get the best out of them, that your natural bias might be towards one way, but their bias might be another? What does that relationship look like?
Interesting. I like to have in the staff people that actually are quite comfortable saying no to me and saying, no, that's a shitty idea. Let's go the other way around. Or convince me or bring their own thoughts to the table. It can get messy because I value just as much the physio's opinion about things than from the assistant coach or team manager. Well, what I do now is, if we have a discussion about players selection, for example, I do it first up with the core hockey coaches. And once we are done with that part of it, I bring it to the whole staff to ask them, what do we miss? What didn't we ask ourselves? Tell us. And then they fire back. Whilst before, pretty much I did that in one call group, and it was a bit messy, you know what I mean? But now you have different. If I talk about things have to do with recovery, injury protocols, I do it just myself with the medical staff, and then we bring it back to the whole, with the rest of the group. In Spain, remember the Euros in Amsterdam before Tokyo? We played the final, and the day after the final with the Dutch boys, I came to Spain. I was 4 days interviewing people for the staff, and because I didn't know a lot of people in Spain at this level as coaches, I let the federation put together names, and we discussed the names. And I just came to talk to people, you know, and not because I wanted to interview them, but because I want to have a feel about them. You know what I mean? I want to look in the eyes, just have a bit of a vibe and see what my belly tells me about them. And it was very funny because there's two guys and they're now in the staff, my assistant coach and another one, best, good, very, very good friends, lived in front of each other in Santander. And on Sunday they were together. And they didn't tell each other on Monday they were coming to Madrid to talk to me. And they found each other on the way in and on the way out. And I was like, huh? And I thought straight away, I like this. There's a lot of loyalty in this. There's a lot of best friends, and they still actually want to keep things to themselves. And I thought, well, this is interesting. I love that. One of them I knew it before, and the other one I didn't know them at all. And I had straight away a really good feeling in my belly. I'm like, wow, this is interesting. Very knowledgeable of the whole youth system of Spain, so even better for me. So yeah, I like to give people a crack. You know what I mean? I don't mind. I'm not scared about the possible repercussions of fallout. For example, in December, we had a 4-day camp before the Olympic qualification tournament, and I invited the coach of Bloomingdale to come and with us on the pitch. First, he's a good friend of mine. He was assistant coach in the Dutch national team with me, so I know him very well. But I brought him not because he's a friend, because I know his critical questions and the way he did things. He was going to rush our thinking process and also the players. So for 4 days, I was putting the coach where he wanted to just glue the. He did everything in English with the Spanish voice 4 days straight. So I'm not concerned about those things because I'm thinking through and I always think that the positives are going to outweigh the negatives of these kind of things. I like to give people a go, but especially I want to have around with people that actually have their own opinion, you know, and their opinion is based on arguments, facts, sometimes feelings, but they're not scared of saying, no, this is the way we go about things. This is the way we should do things. Or this is not a good idea. And we have weekly meetings with the staff. Weekly meetings because A is a big country. Our staff is very diverse. We have one of them living in Alicante, one of them in Santander, one of them living in Madrid, and I live in Barcelona with the keeper's coach. So we have 1 day a week we get together, we go to like a call like this, and we talk topics, we discuss topics, we discuss each other, and it keeps all of us in the loop, you know what I mean, the whole time. And that's quite interesting.
And what's the best question you ask, Max? Do you have a go-to question that you challenge the staff with, or a question that you reflect on that interview that you asked?
No, not really. I mean, I learned from Graham Reed. He told me that one thing in selection, for example, was when he was working with us with the Dutch team, he told me that when he would struggle talking about a player, you know what I mean? I didn't want to pick player X myself. I didn't have him in the team. He told me that what they used to do, I thought, well, this is a really good idea, is just to turn the tables around. So me, that I don't want to choose player X, I have to sell them to the rest of you guys, like I want to pick him. You know, just actually force myself to see the good points of him. I thought, well, that's really good. So that's one thing that we, if we get stuck, that we do, that I picked up from Graham. But now I don't have a go-to question. I like to, literally what I said before, just put everything on the table, actually have a big discussion about it.
And you mentioned earlier immediate reward and attention span of players. I think you coach at the national level, you coach the under-12s at a club or a school, you probably have exactly the same challenges.
Yeah.
What does that look like in your environment? And maybe some top tips and ideas of what that could look like elsewhere. So if you know their challenges, what does that look like in how you deliver a session?
I think you need to set them up for victory. You know what I mean? He set the players up for a good feeling. I think what we fail to do sometimes is we don't give feedback to what's happening. We just give feedback that's very general. So players in the end tend to go back to winning or losing as a measure of success in the training. Be very specific with feedback, you know, name the name, name the action, why the feedback was possible. You know, great work because your feet or because your hands or because your vision of, you know, and just don't say it once. Find ways within the training just to actually pinpoint that part with that player in the things that are developing. And because if you set up a training, let's say, about attacking, finishing, and your feedback is about rewarding the defenders the whole time, players might go like, "What? Huh? I just don't follow you. I just don't get you." So the impact gets lost. So be very specific about feedback. Actually, reward good behaviors, not just good outcomes. And even though they might miss the goal, for example, but if the choice that they make, the shooting techniques that they make was right, just actually reward that part of it publicly. And then actually go, look, maybe if you adjust these things or those things for the next ball, you know what I mean? And that's, I try to be very individual in my feedback in the trainings, not just good work, guys, but why? What did we do that was good work? So they actually go, oh, this is what we need to do. Let's keep on doing more of those stuff. But think the trainings or things that you're doing on the pitch in a way that you're going to reward the right behaviors because they become habits and then they become embedded in their own game and they become more autonomous and more confident and they do things like naturally. I even have with the players in games conversations about this when they've been sucked in the middle of a final, like against Belgium, like, what do you see? They look at me like, what do you see? That action, and like, oh yeah, I thought about that. And so I had a mini conversation with the players whilst the game is going on. You know, that's how I do with the Spanish boys. And in the end, it develops a lot of trust, you know, and it develops a lot of confidence that they actually can do whatever they want to, and they're not going to get sucked because they missed a pass or missed a tackle or they score a goal. And I think in the end, yeah, they develop a much better game understanding in this way.
And to have that look, to have that eye to look individually, there must be a conversation internally with the staff to say, you're going to take this part of training and here's your role and your responsibility to be able to free you up to do that. What does that look like, Max?
Yeah, well, we I think some of our our biggest challenges, coaches, actually, if we give us a canvas, a white canvas to develop things, the list of things we want to train is endless. And we want to do every single topic, and you know, end up doing nothing at all in the end. So once we get our topics together, the things that we need to develop, want to improve on, or want to actually get rid of in our game, then we add de facto time to it. How many trainings do we have? You know, how many games do we have? How many moments do we have together on the pitch? And then you're going to see that list is going to actually diminish quite a lot because you realize you don't have the time for it. Then you start to prioritize. This is important. This is relevant. This is crucial. And then you allocate topics to those different time frames. And then we pretty much split the work. Who's doing what? And once you're in the lead, I'll just blow the whistle, put the cones, and you actually set it up and you explain it. So I'm putting the coach on the pitch, and Borja, my assistant coach, is doing the training. Or Rick in December, the coach from Blumenthal. So I'm just actually getting things, writing things for them. And for example, with the games, with the international games, I always do Spain. I do our own players and our own team. So I don't meddle with let's say, Belgium. Someone else develops Belgium. And of course, we have discussion about always going to present and how and what and why, but I just don't. I sit in the back of the room and they do it. But I always do our team. I always do our players. A national level, international level. What does it mean when I go and watch a club team play? On the iPad, I do the coding of the players that I see playing for the national squad, or 21s or 18s on the pitch. And then on Monday, when I debrief that game at home, I send the coach and the players the clips for their own performance at club level. With the back of the mind, our level, you know what I mean? I don't meddle if they're playing inside forward or striker. I don't care about that. Just care about their behaviors and their habits as a player. So yeah, I mean, we have that part of it very, very clear. In the end, it's about don't become a coach of drills, of games. What do I mean? The players should play the game, not the rules of the game. You know what I mean? Sometimes we try to create a new session, a new wow game, and it's fine. Of course you have to, but be very aware of the impact it's going to have on players. If players on the trainings are always thinking about the rules of the game, am I allowed to do this? I'm not allowed to do that. How do I get points? Instead of actually playing the game itself, it might defeat the purpose. That's why I always, certain periods of preparation, I never bring anything new. You recycle things I already have done, and you go deeper with them in the execution of things. Because I do debrief always Spain, every training that's been filmed, I call the training, and before the next training, I have images of them, of the topics that we're discussing, either individual or as a team. So I try to make them very aware of what do we do, how do we play, how do you play. And it's pretty much 90-10. I think 90% Spain, 10% the opposition, the way that we work.
Yeah. And I was going to mention very similar, I think Pep Guardiola probably shares a very similar approach. It's very much, okay, I'm coaching Man City, I'm not coaching Arsenal, I'm not coaching Liverpool, I'm coaching the philosophy and the values and the behaviours of the team.
Yeah.
And a question for you, when are the differences between principles, tactics, when does tactics become important? How much do you train in tactics? Because I imagine, and I know this, that you don't play 11v11 every single day. So what does that look like to encourage players to understand the tactic, but in a much smaller unit group?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's parts of our sport that are very set play orientated, play on the corners. That's always tactics for me. It's always rhythms, patterns, and execution. I think our game is such a speedy game. A lot of transitions. The ball travels really, really fast. And having hard tactics in place, like maybe football does, I think it's a bit more difficult just to get them right the whole time. So we spend much more, a lot more time in our principles, in our concepts of play. And once we're there, we try to adjust details. That's the tactics part of it, but it's just adjusting things. I think because we bring in a period, the same topics back and forth the whole time, the players see it as normal. So the tactics get embedded through the games. But there's certain parts of it that actually very much for me, like I said before, no penalty corners is one of it. Sometimes long corners defense can also overtake and also be like more set plays than actually the game itself. It was very funny. I love Aussie rules. I watch it every weekend. Every weekend in the season, I watch a game at least. I got, you know, the subscription to the AFL International and the rest. I watch all the games live and I just get really excited and I use a lot of footage of those games with our players as well. But I also love listen to interviews and listen to other coaches talk and what do they say, what they don't say. And I think Craig McRae, he really actually created like a Ted Lasso style of coaching, you know what I mean, the Collingwood and the rest. And I remember in the grand final, they asked him about, you know, I think 2 minutes to go, 5 minutes to go, and the Lions got in front. They were in for the first time in the game, and he goes like, "What do you do?" And they were like, "We trained the whole year for it, you know, restarts, like killing the game, and just trust the concept." I thought, well, wow, you know, that 100,000 people in the MCG grand final footy, the whole country's still, and this guy goes like, "Well, I trust the boys; they know what to do. Let's go and do it now. It's execution time." So through the volume of put them under pressure in trainings and put them in situations of training where they have to think and make choices, in the end, those tactics get embedded, and they came through. Of course, you got some freakish players on that team as well, so that helps a lot. But I'm much more edging towards that part of it than the whole tactics things. And in Spain, especially, big contrast, because the club coaches are very good at tactics, are very good at preparing games to stop or deny or slow down the opposition. But the problem with that for me is that actually every week is something different, so players get lost in translation. So sometimes the contracts with us is very big because we are on the other spectrum. They better be players, empowering players, making them think about themselves, making them the choices. And when they don't know, ask questions. And if they don't know them, we look at them together, also within the game. So it's a very good, you know, different. It makes us, both sides of it, the coach and myself, think about things differently.
And my last question, Max, you go into a new job, and you can speak about it so broadly or specifically, but you go into a new job, you must have a bit of a perception about what you meant. There's an element of maybe you go in there and then you're surprised by something, or you're caught off guard because you don't know, you didn't expect to see that player or that system. Yeah. What does that look like, and how much do you keep? How much do you say, okay, I need to put this aside, this is from a previous role, I've now got a new group, a new environment?
I came in with a bit of a cheat, you know what I mean? Because I knew a lot of players. I think I always love to go and watch the under-16s, 18s, 21s tournaments when I was Dutch coach. So I knew a lot of, and by name, a lot of the talented Spanish kids coming through in Spain. When I came in Spain for the first time, I think I started traveling the country and going and say hello to people. And Max, what do you need of the national coach? What do you expect of the national coach? That was pretty much the only question I asked everyone. I let them tell me everything they felt that was missing or that we had and the rest. And, so I knew what was coming through, but the vibe around the country was like, everyone were like, oh, wow, it's coming a really horrible time. This and this and this and this is stopping the hockey. There's about 8 or 9 players with 200 caps stopping after Tokyo. And what are we going to do? And I was like, we're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. And no one's coming through. So I found that I had to convince them of their own possibilities. You know, I was like, what? This is weird. And because I knew young kids and I love bringing them through and I love to challenge them and to put them in places where they don't expect it to be, I was quite at ease with that. And then in the end, I gave myself, I told the players, we started in October 21 in Galicia. Our first camp was about 40 players, and I was also doing 21's team with us because we were preparing for the World Cup in India that December. So I had about 60 players up in Galicia, and I just actually went there and let them be and actually get to know people, and actually slowly but gently, the things that within that first camp was we spoke about habits that we want to have every time on the pitch to be our thing. And we, in the trainings, we trained and discussed those habits. And in the end, we went through as we went along. So in the next camp, we adjusted things and we started actually developing our own style for those habits. Players were, they still actually ask questions about tactics. Well, I'm going to be with three or with four backs, and I don't know yet, but let's do these three things good now, and we'll see how where we go. So I took them through that journey. And in the end, it's very funny, I came across Danny Carey in Valencia in the qualification tournament one day at the bar, in the restaurant, at the venue. And he went like it was funny. He was watching yesterday you guys play against, Korea. And he went like, wow. I thought, hey, Maxi, those things, he did it with Holland, you know? So I started laughing. I said, Danny, I'm sure you're going to tell me what they were. I'm going to tell you that's probably not true. But if you saw it, you saw what you think you see. Thanks a lot for the feedback. But I mean, sometimes you're very, very wary that your eyes see, you know, what you want to see, that confirmation bias story is true. You know what I mean? We'd be very, very aware of those things. But Danny saw things that I did with Holland, like probably mine, in his view, the way that I see hockey, that I was not aware of, you know what I mean? But with Spain, we developed that from the get-go. We decided as a staff, white canvas, let's start with these three habits. Let's see where it takes us, and let's see how we go about it. And then we start actually adding new stuff, tactics part of it, principles part of it, as we go along. And let's say the players start for a journey and see where we can end up.
Awesome. Max, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for your contribution to the world of hockey, but also not just the hockey players, but the hockey people that you coach. And I'm sure the boys will remember having their parents with them in the meeting before the game for
sure.
The rest of their lives, I'm sure.
Yeah. No worries. It was my pleasure. Have a good day, Olmo.
Thank you for listening to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast. Follow Euro Hockey Org on all social media to keep an eye out for the next episode.